From KALW's The Spiritual Edge podcast, this is our series, Sacred Steps. We take you around the world to meet some remarkable people as they lean on their values and faith to challenge the status quo. I'm Judy Silber. And if after you're listening, you want to hear more of these stories, follow our podcast, The Spiritual Edge. In mid-October of 2020, my husband and I got COVID-19. It was scary. We cycled through symptoms that changed daily. Terrible cough and exhaustion for my husband. For me, fever, nausea, and later a strange tingling in my nerves. The hardest part was not knowing if we'd take a turn for the worse. Our doctors couldn't answer every question, but they checked in with us every few days. Those calls offered a measure of comfort. They signaled that someone cared. We cannot appreciate enough the role of medical workers during this pandemic. They've endured strain and heartbreak, and the trauma of that will likely remain with them for a long time. To start off our new series, Sacred Steps, we offer a tribute to a hospital chaplain in Boston. Her name is Sarah Byrne Martelli, and she's been sitting with COVID patients as they near the end of their lives. Here's reporter Heidi Shin.
Sarah remembers her first day back at work, the feeling of the N95 mask suctioned to her face like a vacuum.
And when you put the N95 on, there's this kind of metal piece over your nose, and you're supposed to push it, and she said, push it through to the back of your skull for 10 seconds, really hard.
Then comes the face mask and the spritz test. It's a sugar spray.
Like if they're, like, blowing air into you? Like if you're, like those bags that when you're trying to help someone breathe, it's like that. They
yeah.
go like, shh, shh. And then they have you read this poem out loud that they hold up.
Does the mask fit tight enough? That's what they were trying to see. Sarah works at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. It's a Harvard teaching hospital. Patients used to fly in from all over the world to see doctors here. But now local COVID cases have taken over the wards. Sarah remembers waiting to start work for the day in the palliative care unit. It's where she works with patients who are facing the end of their lives.
It's like, you know, I feel like I'm in the movie E.T. or something, you know, at the end with all like the equipment and the white, you know, the white suits and everything. I feel like they must feel like they're in some sort of weird sci-fi experience.
It was the spring of 2020, the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic in Boston. The death toll was rising and the city was under lockdown for the first time. Ambulance sirens became the civic soundtrack. People stressed about where and how to get their groceries. They applauded frontline workers from their balconies at 8 o'clock every night. Sarah Byrne Martelli is one of those frontline workers at Mass General. She's not a physician or a medical worker, though. She's a chaplain in palliative care, the person who sits with you and prays with you in your last days of life. Now, Sarah is not who you might picture. No stiff robes, she favors skirts and dresses and black patent leather clogs, the kind you see doctors and nurses wear because they're on their feet all day. Her hair is in what she calls a permanent messy ponytail. She's not Catholic, though that's what most of her patients think. She's Eastern Orthodox, kind of a trailblazer in her church, actually. The first woman chaplain in her denomination ever.
Like, I have these ridiculous pictures of me with, like, all very, very bearded Orthodox priests. it's like one of these things is not like the other.
And was that hard?
Yes, yes, it was.
Since then, other women have followed. Sarah's mentored them. And 18 years later, I feel like it's this kind of willingness to dive in. It helps Sarah in her work as a chaplain. Now, let me share with you what a typical day would look like for Sarah before COVID. Hospital life was pretty frenetic. There would have been a flurry of doctors and nurses trying to figure out what else they could do for a patient who's dying. Meanwhile, their families are wondering, is it okay to take somebody that I love off a respirator so their life would end? Or does this mean that we're trying to play God? And this is when the medical staff calls for Sarah, the chaplain.
And the thing is, for me, like, I hope that too, right? Always. And I also know that sometimes miracles don't happen in the time frame or in the way that we want.
And before COVID, one of Sarah's most surprising roles was this one. she'd get families who've been fighting to start talking again. She's the kind of person who can get you to open up, like someone you've known for a long time, even though you just met. She's steadfast, warm, and even the medical teams in the ICU say she's surprisingly funny.
I kind of made a joke to the medical, like the MICU attending, like, I'll just start praying so they can't start arguing with each other.
She'll help people tell stories. Sometimes she'll even give them hugs. She'll whisper in a patient's ear as their breathing starts to slow. She's a human touch in a sea of machines and procedures that sustain someone at the end of their life. Once the pandemic hit, things looked different. When the hospital sent Sarah to work from home, she placed iPads by her patients' bedsides and cared for them by phone. But there's only so much you could do from a distance. After a few weeks, she went back into the hospital to see patients again in person. By then, the hospital had become a battleground with focused intensity. Mass General closed its coffee shops and restricted visitors. COVID patients had taken over, and many were dying alone. Sarah tells me about the first COVID patient she saw in person. He was a man in his 70s.
And so I went in and saw him, and he had a trach, so a breathing tube in his neck to breathe. He still needed the help of a ventilator. And he had protective mitts on his hands. They're kind of like these pillow things like that you put around your whole hand, which meant that he had at some point must have tried to pull out his tubes because you get delirious when you're in the ICU. You know, when I introduced myself, he turned his head and looked right at me. He would nod a little bit. He would cough a lot. And, you know, being a human myself and being new to the COVID experience, it was a little scary every time he would cough because then I would wonder, am I too close to him? I was worried because my glasses started to fog up, and then I thought, okay, are they supposed to fog up?
She pauses. She's not sure what to do. Is her mask working?
I don't know, but now it's too late because I'm in here, so I'm gonna just try to, you know, I'm gonna just do my best. And he couldn't speak. And so, you know, the question is, how do you help someone who's grieving grieve when they can't speak? And he looked so sad. And, you know, I introduced myself. I wasn't sure if he really comprehended who I was.
He had just lost his wife to COVID. They'd been admitted together. He just learned of her death, but he couldn't see her. He was on a respirator and isolated. Doctors and nurses didn't know what else they could do for him, so they sent Sarah in. She knew the man was a Christian, so Sarah found some psalms to read for him.
Psalm 88. O Lord God of my salvation, when at night I cry out in your presence, let my prayer come before you, incline your ear to my cry. For my soul is full of troubles, and my life draws near to Sheol. I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like those who have no help, like those forsaken among the dead.
And so I read some of those, hoping that that would be comforting and maybe familiar words to him if that was something he did in the past. And prayed with him. And I felt helpless. I felt like I didn't know if what I did made a difference. I will never know. And it's important to be okay with that not knowing. You know, in moments like that, the most important thing you can do is just be quiet, be reverent, respectful, not fill in the space with just like chatter, but to really just try to honor what's going on. And that's important.
Yeah. Does death scare you, having seen so much of it?
No. I mean, what scares me is people who are in really bad pain or people who are alone, people who don't have support. That definitely scares me.
To be alone at the end of life, to be without people who care for you, who love you. During the time of COVID, this happened to so many. Families grieving over Zoom, friends offering condolences on Facebook. Meanwhile, Sarah is there in person to ensure that no one dies alone.
You're listening to KALW's The Spiritual Edge podcast. You can hear more great stories like the one you're hearing right now by following The Spiritual Edge in your podcast app, or go to thespiritualedge.org. And please, invite a friend to listen too. Now back to the story.
And I will dwell in the house of the Lord, close by His side.
In those early months, Sarah found herself praying, not just for the patients, but for the doctors, the nurses, and others on her team. They turned to her during quiet conversations in the hallway, and at their morning huddle, she led them in meditations. Even for professionals who often saw death, the pandemic was just too much. They were exhausted. They were scared of getting the virus themselves, and some did. Sarah remembers this one doctor at the hospital who became a patient.
And she was proned. You may have heard about this, where they're putting patients face down. So she's like lying flat on her stomach on a ventilator with all the tubes. And she was there for weeks and weeks. She had contracted it while caring for other people.
I asked if there was a doctor I could interview for the story. None would talk on record. At a recent staff training, a facilitator asked the doctors to share about what had happened in the early days of COVID care. Telling their stories, it re-traumatized them. They survived, and they'd rather put it behind them.
The Lord is my shepherd.
Sarah tries not to cry at work in front of her patients. But after she leaves the hospital, things are different. She remembers that first day back at work during the pandemic, finishing her shift.
And on the way home, I was driving home, and it was a downpour of rain, which felt very appropriate. And I actually, weirdly, sort of ran a red light, which is totally not something I normally do, but I was paying attention, but I just sort of slowly drove through this red light, and a cop pulled me over, actually, which was crazy. And it's, again, a downpour. And I roll down my window and the rain starts like flinging through into my window. And I start bawling my eyes out. I was just bawling. And he was like, "Are you okay? Or you just drove through?" I was like, "I know, I'm sorry. I work at Mass General and I've had a really hard day." And, you know, and I just was sobbing. The cop was just like, "Okay, you're fine. Just don't do that again." I said, "Okay." But it was one of those where it really hit me. And I had a good cry when I got home. And my husband and son were very sweet. And they brought me some tea and a glass of wine and just a blanket and let me cry. And that's important, too.
At the end of the day, Sarah gets home where her husband and her son are waiting for her. There's an elaborate ritual. She changes from hospital clothes, disinfects, puts on clean clothes. Of course, she's afraid of bringing the virus home. But that doesn't keep her from telling her son about her work.
So, what do I do for my job?
You sometimes, if they're feeling a little worried or sad about something, you either like play a song or do things or do the Lord's Prayer. Okay, bye.
I think he has a weird sense of life and death, like in a way that maybe other six-year-olds don't. We talk a lot about the circle of life. You know, he has this kind of deep sense of that, which is good. He sees me cry here and there, and he knows, and I'm just very careful to tell him that, like, I love my work. I think it's amazing. It's like, I love what I do, and it's hard, and it's joyful, and it's everything. It's just very... Life is very lifey, as my best friend and I like to say. It's just very full.
It's these really simple moments when she's home with her family and her kids just being a kid. This helps her on her hardest days.
There is nothing more wonderful than a big full body hug from my large, tall 6-year-old son. And there is nothing better than going in the sprinkler with him after work, you know, or spraying him with the hose and chasing him around, or... eating ice cream, you know, listening to music, dancing around. And so I try to do all those things too with him, which keeps me grounded and keeps me, you know, it brings joy into my life.
As a hospice chaplain, Sarah has a glimpse of the end of life in a way that most of us don't. She knows what kinds of regrets people have and what kinds of questions they ask.
People wouldn't necessarily define them as, you know, spiritual questions. I think people like existential kind of questions, questions about meaning. What is my life? Like, what has my life been? How have I spent my time? Who have I loved?
Recently, Sarah officiated her first ever wedding. It was at a patient's bedside during the pandemic. The couple had been together for over 50 years.
There were like 15 nurses standing there outside the patient's room, which has glass doors. So you can see in, there he is, and he's on. He has a non-rebreather, which is like this kind of big mask that blows oxygen right up into your face. And so the point is, this patient is very sick. His sweet wife came in, and with her little, like, she was like very short and she had little glasses and gray hair, very pretty. But it was just so clear that the medical staff needed something joyful. We needed to be part of something that felt hopeful. And so when it was time to go in, she actually put on this tiara. It was so cute. It was like this beautiful kind of rhinestone or like fancy rhinestone crystal tiara. The nurse had like her iPhone in her back pocket and was playing some music. We had them say, you know, their vows and I do. And I thought, oh my goodness, suddenly this is very real. Till death do us part in this case means probably till tomorrow. And sometimes the vows are as long as we both shall live. So I chose to use the as long as we both shall live.
Together, they lit a unity candle. He kept it by his bedside until he died the next day.
Do you ever pray about, like, how to approach your work? Do you ever pray about what should I do about this patient or this family?
Oh, yes, very much. I try to gather myself before I go visit a patient and to take just even a pause, a moment of silence, a moment where I can just say kind of, you know, may I be the person that is needed right now, like that my words or my actions be healing or be a compassionate presence that doesn't make this person suffering worse.
She says that the end of life can be hard for a lot of people. There's pain and regrets. You think about what you set out to do and what you've actually done. But there is a way to find peace at the end of it all.
If you can kind of process some of the meaning or the ways that you've helped the world, even in a small way, I think it can give you some peace at end of life. I really do.
Since she works so closely with death, Sarah thinks a lot about the choices that she's making now.
You know, I've been thinking about this recently. I really hope that forgive me, it's not the first time you're saying it to someone, is at their deathbed. I think that's why it's helpful to talk about this stuff now, so that at the end of life, it's not a big rush to apologize for everything and to suddenly declare your love for someone. I mean, oftentimes people are estranged, right? They don't have good relationships. And, you know, we do our best to reconnect if we can.
She tries to follow the advice she gives to her patients. And she wonders, all those things we wait to say until the end of life, I love you, I forgive you, why not say them sooner? For The Spiritual Edge, this is Heidi Shen.
That story was reported by Heidi Shen. You've been listening to a story from the Sacred Steps series. We're a production of KALW's The Spiritual Edge in collaboration with USC's Center for Religion and Civic Culture. If you haven't already, follow The Spiritual Edge podcast wherever you listen. We've got more great stories on the way, and you won't want to miss them. Support for Sacred Steps comes from the John Templeton Foundation and the Templeton Religion Trust. Cheryl Duvall is the Sacred Steps editor. Tarek Fuda is the engineer. Lindsay Myers-Humley is the digital content manager. Tom Levy is the photographer for The Spiritual Edge. We're grateful to all the people who helped get this Spiritual Edge podcast out into the world, including Megan Suisse, Heba Farag, Ben Trefney, Shireen Adel, Sadia Termizi, Jeffrey Burke-Witten, and Megan Jones. We'd love it if you could help share the word about these stories with your networks. Here's a few ways you can help. You can give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. You can like what we share on social media and share what we share with your friends. We also have a newsletter where you can get updates on Spiritual Edge programming and stories. Go to The Spiritual Edge to sign up. I'm Judy Silber. Thanks for listening.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.